From the studios of WICR at the University of Indianapolis, I'm Richard Brendan, and this is Journey's Fire. You know, all of us at some time experience loss. We feel alone, shocked, confused, and heartbroken, no longer tethered to the life we had, but not yet able to recognize the new landscape of our lives and what it offers. Well, in a new book called Opening to Grief, Finding Your Way from Loss to Peace is a guide for this tender time. And with the demeanor and tone of a loving friend, author Claire Willis helps move past the prevailing idea that grief moves in stages. Instead, she offers a personal path, an invitation to turn toward the emotions and sensations that arise and explore the ways that are most healing for you. Claire Willis is a clinical social worker who's worked in the fields of oncology and bereavement for more than 20 years. A co-founder of the Boston nonprofit Facing Cancer Together, Willis has led bereavement, end-of-life support, and therapeutic writing groups. She's co-taught spiritual resources for healing the mind, body, and soul at Andover Newton Theological School. She maintains a private practice in Brooklyn, Massachusetts. As a lay Buddhist chaplain ordained by Joan Halifax at Upaya Zen Center in Santa Fe, she focuses on contemplative practice for end-of-life care. I have enjoyed reading this book, and it's such an honor for me to have her on today's program, and she's joining us from Boston, Massachusetts. Claire Willis, welcome to the program.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for asking me to come.
Well, it's an honor. I so appreciate the work you've done over the years, and I love this new book, Opening to Grief, that was written along with Marnie Crawford Samuelson. It's filled with such a wealth of information, also exercises. It's a nice guidebook, I suppose, for people who are navigating the journey of grief. But I want to open up with something that is written in this book. And you say, you could think of grief as a sacred passage. You were torn from the life you knew before. You're not who you were, and you're not who you will become. Like everything else, you are changing. You are, in a very real way, between identities. This experience, profoundly different for each of us, is confusing, agonizing, and potentially life-transforming. Mm. Those are powerful words.
It's a strong promise, isn't it?
It is. It is.
And what you want to... What are you gonna?
Yeah, what intrigued me about this, and I think this is one of the first things that you write in the book, is when you wrote this book, everything was, you wrote this book at a simpler time, at least it seemed that way. When 2020 began, our routines felt familiar. Of course, then the pandemic came.
Yes, it was, we wrote it really to deal with more of the particular griefs, the ordinary everyday griefs that people experience. And then the pandemic came, and a lot of what we wrote is no different for the pandemic. It's just that the pandemic is a larger grief. All in all, at the bottom line is that grief is about love, and grieving is about the expression of love. And that's what, when we can allow ourselves to become undefended, open-hearted, and really feel the suffering that's there, it connects us and it tenderizes us, and it has the capacity to really transform us into having a deeper relationship to ourselves and to others who are suffering. And it allows us, in our ability to be with our own suffering, it allows us to be with the suffering of others in a much more gracious, compassionate way.
And so the book is broken down into four sections. The last one I love because it's all inspirational readings and writings people can get a hold of. So thank you for that. I think those things are very important to have, especially if you have a book like this. It's such a guidebook. But part one of this book, and it's broken down in various chapters, is opening to grief. So to be able to do what you're talking about, we first need to be open to that, don't we? And that's hard.
It's really hard. And I think there's not a lot of cultural support for grieving in an overt way. It's a strange thing. Even in my bereavement groups, where people have lost long-term partners, for the most part, if they break down in tears, they'll often say, "Oh, I'm so sorry." And I say, "If you can't cry here, where can you cry?" And what's the apology about? You know, we're in a bereavement group, but there's not a lot of cultural support for grief in an overt way. And there's expectations, I think, based on some of the models that have been overlaid on the culture, that we move through it faster than we do, and we move through it in a particular way. And in truth, grief has as many faces as there are people who are grieving.
Yeah.
And so to have expectations about what it looks like, one of the things that I think that we talk a little bit about is the nuances of grief, mm-hmm. that grief isn't just sorrow. Grief can be anxiety, it can be despair, it can be agitation. It's very often it's anger, because anger gives people a false sense of agency in the face of helplessness. And if we can't tolerate helplessness, it's easy to go to anger or rage. It can look like loneliness, it can look like gratitude, and it can look like regret. It can look like so many things, but we tend to think it's only sorrow or sadness.
Yeah.
So we don't always recognize it when we're feeling it.
So people, just as people grieve differently, just as each person's an individual, everyone grieves in their own different way.
Everybody grieves in their own way. You know, I remember this article that appeared in the Boston Globe, written by a woman named Joan Wickersham, who does a lot with grief, and she talked about going to a cocktail party, and she meets a man there who has remarried in a year his wife's best friend after she died. And then she meets another woman who's been a widow for 4 years, and every time she meets somebody at the party, she mentions her husband's name. And she talks about how both of these are extreme expressions of grief. And I love that anecdote because it makes room for whatever is your journey.
I love that.
Isn't that lovely? Yeah, it's everybody's journey is different, and how can we honor them without being judgmental about what it should look like? And I think that's one of the problems with some of the models. We attach ourselves to a model, and we think, oh, I didn't go through that stage. I hear this a lot in my bereavement groups. Am I grieving right? Is it supposed to look like this? My husband died 3 months ago, and I'm not crying. Is something wrong?
Well, and Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was such a pioneer and such an amazing
yes.
woman, and wrote so many great books, and she had those five stages of grief. But what you're saying, and I think people are finally getting it, they don't come in any particular order, folks.
Well, I think, yes, that, but I think more importantly, when she wrote those stages,
yeah.
she wrote them for people who were dying.
Yeah.
They were never meant to be applied to grief. They were for people who were dying. Now, can you overlay them on grief? Some people might fit that, but most people don't. And it's certainly never sequential. It's back and forth and back and forth. It's not a straight line. There's no one roadmap that we can overlay on this journey,
yeah.
which is so particular.
You have a chapter titled Meeting Grief as a Companion. I'd like for you to talk more about that, because for some of our listeners, for many of them maybe, that's going to sound odd. What do you mean, making it a companion?
I've had a lot of people ask me this question. We wanted the book. Ironically enough, a lot of the endorsers of the book described the book as a companion to grief, which was exactly what we had hoped for. We wanted the book to be a companion, and by companion, we mean we wanted people to feel less alone in reading the book, that they would read the book and they'd say, oh, other people do this, other people say this, other people sleep with their husband's clothes on so they can keep his smell. You know, there are so many secrets around it, and we wanted, by making it more acceptable and normal, to have people be able to have grief be a companion, because there's so much in our culture to be grieving. There is, I mean, just look at what's happening. Well, we can look at what's happening politically, but we can also look at what's happening to the climate. There's so much to grieve. And if we don't feel the impact of these things, we're not going to respond to them. We need to respond to the sorrow in the world. So if we can't make grief a companion, and part of what we wanted to do was make this book, give people resources through this book so that they would be better able to take grief on as a companion
yeah.
and not have it be something that they implode with or have to deny or push away, because what we resist will persist. That's not a way through. And if we can find our way to hold grief, we'll find ourselves more loving of ourselves and other people. That grief is an expression of our love. So to deny it is to deny our loving.
Because to grieve means that you've lost someone worth grieving.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
If we lose something politically, it's something we loved. Environmentally, we're losing things we love, losing places.
Yeah, and so you write in this book that even though it might be hard to believe or accept at first, grief can be seen as an invitation to grow and eventually find meaning in the suffering.
Yes.
That's the journey that they want
that
to
That is the journey,
yeah.
Yes.
What role does meditation play?
Well, I think it depends on the person. Mm-hmm. But one of the ways that it helps keep someone right in the moment and to help them become aware of their thinking or habitual thoughts, which can often be destructive and not loving or kind to ourselves. It also keeps us from jumping into the future with anxiety, which is really easy to do, or looking back with longing for something that we can no longer have. So it's an invitation to be aware of our habitual thinking and to stay in the present moment and to steady ourselves. Because, you know, I remember reading this research that 50% of the time our minds are in the future and 40% of the times our minds are in the past. And 10% of the time, on a really good day, our minds are where our bodies are. And meditation helps us stay in the moment, which is generally nowhere near as frightening as what our future thoughts are when we're grieving or are looking back.
Yes.
So it helps us break some of those habitual conditioned patterns of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And it also is calming and steadying to our minds. And it's also an invitation to be compassionate and kind to ourselves, depending on the practice we take on.
So having some kind of meditation practice, and there's so many tools out there that people can tap into, but you also have meditations in this book, is really going to be key for those who are going through grief. And you mentioned a word about a few minutes ago in our conversation that I want to talk about now. You mentioned kindness, the need to be kind to yourself. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, I think that there's a prevailing idea in our sort of capitalist society of suck it up and move on.
Oh,
you know,
yes.
if you even, and I think it often is overlaid on men more than women,
mm-hmm.
although I think it's also overlaid on women too. But just think about this. When you have a death in the family, often what happens, how many days off does a company usually give you? 3 or 4.
Yeah, that's it.
That's it. You're expected to go back and you're expected to produce at the level that you left.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just not possible. It doesn't respect the process of grief. So the practice of metta, which means loving kindness, but it also means something I just learned called tender friend.
Oh, I love that.
So I often teach the people with whom I work metas, and some of the common ones I use are, may I be free of fear, may I have strength for my journey, may I accept all my feelings of grief, may I allow my heart to be open. Those are the kinds of metas I often use when people are grieving, because people need to be invited to grieve. They need permission to grieve, because you're not going to get permission in a lot of our culture. I mean, one of the things I hear a lot, Richard, which I'm sure you know about as a chaplain, is people will say, when so-and-so died, my friends that I thought would move in towards me disappeared, and other friends came forward that I never anticipated that would be that close in my life, and I don't understand this. You know, so a lot of it has to do with our own capacity to be with our own sorrow. When we can be with our own sorrow, we can be with the sorrow of other people.
Yes. Well, and you have these examples written in this book. And so for those who are listening, one example would be, may I welcome all my feelings as I grieve. May I allow grief to soften and strengthen my heart, and may I hold my sorrow with tenderness and compassion.
Yes. Yeah, it makes a big difference. Because whatever we resist will persist.
That is so true.
It's so true.
Yeah.
And I think it's Alan Wolfelt, I think, talks about not allowing ourselves to grieve. And I love this phrase. I have it a little bit out of context, but it's living against ourselves.
Yeah.
And that creates stress. That's hard. It creates a hardening of our hearts. It disconnects us from people. Mm. When we have to inhibit our sorrow, it's a lot of energy to keep that sorrow under wraps. It's a lot of energy.
And we're not even aware of it.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I want to do, I'm hoping will come out through this book, and I kind of wish I'd written more about this, is that there's a lot of invisible griefs in our culture. And they're invisible because they're disenfranchised or they're stigmatized. So one of the griefs that's come up a lot in a couple of the interviews I've had is about pet grief. And it happens that I've interviewed two people that have had pets and lost pets. And it's a grief that people don't share because they feel ashamed of it. But in fact, losing a pet for many people is like losing a child. And that may sound difficult to some people, but if you don't have children and that pet's been where you've doted all your focus and you lose it, it's for those people like losing a child.
Absolutely. How much of it? Go ahead.
It's a pure, unconditional love we have for pets.
Yes.
Our love for people is complicated.
Yes.
It's not that it's less, it's different. It's complicated, it has history, it has complexity, but the love we have for an animal has very little complexity to it. It's simple and pure and unconditional.
Mm.
And so the loss of an animal is really a tough one for people.
I heard someone share, maybe it was on radio, I don't even remember who it was, but their observation was this, that everybody's grieving. He says, guaranteed, if you go to the grocery store, drugstore, if you go to a meeting, there will be people in that room grieving over the loss of. And then he filled it in with like 50 different things.
That's right.
That's really what this book is addressing. It's grief of all kinds.
Grief of all kinds. That's right. And there's a lot of what we call disenfranchised grief. Grief where someone is physically present but psychologically absent.
Yeah.
So people who are with dementia, mental illness, inmates. Mm. I was corresponding with an inmate for 3 years. I never met him.
Mm-hmm.
I adored this person. And when I got a phone call from a guard one day telling me he had died, I started to cry. Now, I'd never met this person, but I'd done a lot of work advocating. It turns out this, I'm talking about him as a man. He started out letting me know he was, he was a man. And then in the process of our relationship of writing letters back and forth, he came out to me as trans. And I did a lot of advocacy work for him. You can imagine what it's like to live in a male prison with being a transgendered.
Yeah.
And she was so brave and constantly harassed. And when I got the phone call, she died. I started to cry and I thought, wow, I've never even met her. Mm. And I loved her. I loved her courage and her advocacy and her capacity to speak for who she was at the most authentic level.
Mm.
It was very moving. So that's a disenfranchised grief. You know, people would say, you never met her. How can you grieve for her?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I kind of kept it to myself, but I knew it was real. I loved this woman, and my grief was an expression of my love for her.
You know, observation I've made over the years regarding death, but also specifically regarding grief, and that is, with all the differences we have in the world, with all the cultural differences and political differences, it strikes me that for the most part, everyone grieves at the loss of a child.
That's
it could be a terrorist whose child is killed in a bomb. It could be anybody, anywhere. And when you see it on TV, people are crying. People are wailing. We have that in common, don't we? Because we have death in common. Nobody gets out alive.
Strong bonds are forged through suffering. mutual suffering.
That is so true.
Right? So when we deny our own suffering, we're really cutting ourselves off from the many people around us who suffer. You know, I think getting to know our suffering opens our heart and tenderizes us in very particular and beautiful ways if we can bear it. And hopefully the book offers people resources to strengthen their capacity to bear their own sorrow.
Absolutely. I've always believed in terms of learning anything, it's almost like a three-step process. The first has to be the awareness. The second step is the mastery, or the transformation, the daily practice, and then the mastery. This book that you've written, I think, helps provide that awareness. It reminds people, oh yeah, I am grieving. It's okay to grieve. This book also is a tool to help you in the transformation process, to rewire your brain a little bit, to start grieving in a more healthy way.
Yes, thank you. That's exactly what we hoped. And to give grief space for expression.
Yeah.
Now we need to give it a place in our lives.
Give it expression. I like that phrase.
Yeah.
And to have a community, even if it's a relatively small community, to allow us to do that, I would think, is hugely important. And you do address that in this book.
Yeah, it is important. And, you know, it's a common issue. As I said before, people find that close friends disappear. People that were more acquaintances tend to come forward. I'm sure you've seen this in your work, where the landscape, and we call these sort of secondary losses, the landscape of our friendship network changes, for instance, if we lose a partner, because we're no longer a couple. And then we don't get asked out in the same way by the community, at least over a period of time. So it's complicated, and community, if you can find a bereavement group and a beloved community that's well-led and holds grief in a sacred way, you really have something special. Or a grief friend. They talk on the website, What's Your Grief? The women that run that talk about finding a grief friend, and I love that. Someone who knows or has been the root of sorrow that you're on.
Well, and there's plenty of grief groups, even on Facebook, too, people could be a part of, where they'll have Zoom calls and such.
That's right.
How much of it also is people, when people know someone who's gone through loss, they just don't know what to say, so they don't say anything.
They don't say anything, but I think there's that, but I also think what's happening is they don't want to say anything because they're afraid of upsetting you. So they're but in fact, what they're really worried about is if you get upset, how they're going to respond. What people don't realize is that that person is probably thinking about their loved one anyway. So one of the things I hear a lot, and I'm sure you've heard this too, Richard, I went to Thanksgiving dinner, and it was the first one without my husband, and no one mentioned his name. I hear that a lot. We had a family gathering, and it was the first one, and no one mentioned. And so then we talk about ways to bring the name of your loved one to the table without having people feel uncomfortable. I wonder what Richard would have thought of this dinner. Oh, these were his favorite potatoes. Does anybody remember other things about Richard that they'd like to share? So that it breaks the ice, and the person doesn't feel so alone in their grief.
There's something else you share in the book that you find very important, and that's feeling grateful. And you talk about even having a gratitude journal. Can you talk about that process? Because I think that would be very important in this transformational process as we're trying to learn and grow through our grief.
You know, I think I'm glad you brought this up, because I think gratitude can be a really difficult thing to think about when you're grieving. But the reason I have a chapter in it in the book is that gratitude is a practice that actually helps build our resilience to hold our suffering. So if we think about the fact that our mind is habituated towards the negative. Now, that's not a bad thing, but it's the way we're hardwired. It's how we've learned to survive. We notice what's wrong, and so we act accordingly. But while that was necessary in ancient times, it's no longer necessary now. So what happens is that negative experiences adhere to us as Rick Hansen says, like Velcro. We don't ever forget a negative experience. Positive experiences flow through us like water over Teflon. We don't remember them in the same way that we remember negative ones.
Yes.
So on a morning you wake up and your coffee maker overflows or your toilet gets clogged or you have a fender bender on the way to work, you get to work and you say, I've had a terrible morning. But when the coffee maker works and the toilet works and you get to work without an episode, you don't say, wow, everything worked, because you don't even notice it.
Wow,
so part of the practice is to start to linger and notice what's good for 10 to 30 seconds, and that actually will begin over a period of 3 weeks to rewire your brain to notice what's good alongside what's wrong. So keeping a gratitude journal becomes a way to start to discipline your mind to notice what's good. One of the things to remember is we always say to people, write down three gratitudes at the end of the day, because what happens is the next day you know you're going to keep that journal, so you start to look for what's right so that you can record what you've noticed. The tricky thing is when you write your gratitudes is not to express them in negative language. That makes a big difference. So, for instance, if let's say I have four children in the house, so negative language would be, I'm grateful the children weren't noisy today, as opposed to, I'm grateful the house was peaceful. You hear the difference. But
yes,
we're so used to expressing things in the negative, and it doesn't rewire our brain in the same way when we express positive things with negative language. So keeping the gratitude journal helps redirect our attention towards what's good, and it strengthens our capacity to hold our grief. And that's why it was important, because always when someone dies, there are acts of kindness that come our way, and we need to pause to notice them and take them in, and not to let them obliterate the sorrow, but to hold them next to the sorrow.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense. It really
you know,
does.
It's interesting because, you know, if I teach a class, when I teach a class, I often teach this topic because I love this topic. And I'll say to them, at the end of the class, if you write an evaluation, my attention is going to look for the negative feedback. Even though I'm talking about gratitude, I know that's where I'm going to look. I'm going to look at who circled one or two instead of five, you know? It's like we all do this.
Sounds like someone we have in political office who does the same thing.
Do you
happen to have your book with you, Opening to Grief?
I have the Uncorrected Proof, yeah.
Yes, okay. If you could turn to the chapter on opening to mindfulness and meditation, which is, I think, 24, 25.
Got it.
I would like for you to read that personal reflection. I thought that was so powerful.
Okay. My son Daniel was 30 when he died in a climbing accident. Although I'd been living alone for many years, I found it unbearable after Dan's death to come home to an empty house. Every evening after work, I would drop in on friends or go to a movie or eat alone in a crowded restaurant. Most nights, I find a bar where I could sit until closing time. Before long, it took an extra drink to numb the feeling of desolation that was waiting to greet me when I unlocked the front door. All this busyness was a distraction, but I couldn't even seem to stop. I had a vague sense of yearning for something more satisfying, but I didn't know what it was. When a coworker suggested I attend her meditation class, I reluctantly agreed to try. At first, I couldn't sit still. My mind raced. I spoke to the instructor, who suddenly suggested that I try connecting some words to my breath to help focus my mind. I can't say exactly how long it took, maybe a month, before I noticed that my restlessness was easing and I felt a sense of settling inside myself. I started to meditate at home for 5 minutes each morning. Then after a few weeks, I sat a little longer. I began to see that time is wrapping my arms around my heart.
I thought that was a perfect illustration of what we've been talking about, and especially about meditation, how you can start from nowhere.
Yes.
But have to repeat it. And I love that last line, I began to see that time as wrapping my arms around my heart. That was so beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
That's I think of it that way too. I think that's a lovely way to think about it, especially if you're doing a meta practice. You know,
absolutely.
And that's I think tethering our breath to words is a good way for beginners to start. It creates a little structure.
That phrase, tethering our breath. I was about to ask you about breath, but let's go back to that. What do you mean by tethering our breath?
So, for instance, Thich Nhat Hanh has some wonderful from the blooming lotus, breathing in, I soften my belly, breathing out, I relax my body. So that the breath is connected to a phrase, or breathing in, may I be free, breathing out of fear. So that we're putting our mind to the inhalation and the exhalation. And it helps to quiet the mind rather than just following the breath, although following the breath is a wonderful practice.
Yes.
But I think it can be harder for people who are beginning not to have a device, a little bit of a device, maybe counting 1, 2, 3, 4, or tethering the breath to some words that are soothing, especially if we're grieving. I think that's important.
Absolutely.
Well, and it reinforces more positive thinking as well, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, one of the short meditations you have in this book that touched my heart, it's, may I allow moments of quiet and stillness. May I feel my breath as I breathe in. May I feel my breath as I breathe out.
Yeah.
As I open to grief, may I hold my suffering tenderly. Beautiful.
Yeah. I love that part of the book.
I do too. And in opening to grief, it's really about opening up your heart, isn't it?
It is. That's exactly what it's about, Richard. It's about opening your heart and allowing your heart to break open over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't stay in sorrow. It moves into love, and I have felt a connection with people in sorrow that I don't feel in the same way as in joy. I mean, I feel in joy, but it's a different connection when sorrow meets sorrow.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because you know you're not alone.
Yes. And that's comforting, isn't it, to know you're not
alone? It sure is. I mean, that's why a well-led bereavement group works. People can finish each other's sentences.
Claire, what do you say to those people out there? They say COVID's going to spike up again. With all the quarantining, especially in March and April, people were isolated. And because of that, mental health illnesses were going up, especially people who had no community. They were alone. They were living by themselves, probably didn't even have a cat or a dog. What do you say to people like that who are feeling so alone?
I say, try and get outside. Try and see if there is some little thing you can do for somebody that you know, even if it's a phone call, even if it's a visit to drop off something they need or see if there's something they need. I find that being of service in whatever simple way I can mitigates the loneliness and the isolation. It activated me into wanting to do something to help with this. And not everybody gets organized that way. Some people implode in depression. Some people just get anxious. People have different coping mechanisms. But to find some meaning in the suffering by being of service to something, even if you're just writing a letter to an inmate, or you're writing a letter to your doctor to tell your doctor how grateful you feel for the fact that they're working and putting their lives on the line. There's always something we can do.
Yes. One of the things you said, get outside. I love how this conversation is flowing, because I was going to ask you about a chapter you also wrote on, and it's near and dear to my heart, because I have to tell you, when I need to make a major decision, or if I'm in some kind of sorrow or what have you, my sanctuary has always been nature.
Me too.
The woods, the water. Yes.
That's right.
You have a chapter on restoring in nature. Talk about the importance of that.
Oh, there's a lot of research that actually points to the fact that restoring ourselves in nature actually increases our immune system. It lessens despair. It lessens anxiety. And I know that a lot of people last year in March, when we were all quarantined, we would go outside on the weekends and try to leave the city when we could and be in the natural world. I mean, in part, the nature offers us a mirror to our own process. You know, we have storms, we have stillness, we see the restoration in maybe the word is rejuvenation. In nature, we see the life-death cycle in the seasons, and seeing that and being with it is important. The other thing about nature is that many of us are inside a lot of the time with our work, with computers, and our eyes are strained. When we go into the natural world asks nothing of us. We have only to receive what's there. We look out, and our eyes relax, our mind relaxes, and there's some way that our body just lets down in a way that we can't do in our homes. Mm. It's just different. And the Kaplans have done a lot of research about restorative environments.
Yes, they have. You allude to some other research. Also in your book, you write, across Canada, people have formed walking groups to help with grief. They gather, stand together, and share memories. Some cry. No one tries to fix anything. Oh, I love that.
I know. It's just bearing witness to each other's journey.
Yes.
They say the name of the person they lost, and they just listen, and no one advises.
Yeah.
They just be with one another.
Absolutely.
Isn't that beautiful? Yeah.
We touched on this a bit, but let's revisit it again, and that's that we do need other people. Never more often. And you have a beautiful quote from Andre Nouwen, one of my favorite writers. And he said, the friend who can be silent with us in a moment of despair or confusion, who can stay with us in an hour of grief and bereavement, who can tolerate not knowing, not healing, not curing, that is a friend who cares. I love that quote.
Those are the kinds of friends we need when we're grieving.
Mm.
There's a wonderful article by Rachel Remen, who it's called Helping, Fixing, Serving. And she says, we're not here to help each other. We're not here to fix each other. We're here to be of service to each other. And when people are grieving, being of service means being willing to listen with an open heart and mm-hmm. offer nothing but loving presence. Mm-hmm. That's all that's needed.
Yeah. And that's the need of something you've talked about, and to find a support group somewhere, whether it be online or in person. I know with COVID,
yes.
we're kind of hindered a little bit on some of
yes. that. Yes, yeah, but there's a ton. I mean, we're hindered and we're helped mm-hmm. because there's a ton of resources online that don't require geographical location. So, I mean, for instance, my bereavement group has people outside of the city and outside of the geographic area I live in, and one of my groups has someone from Canada in it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's opened up possibilities at the same time that it's closed things. It's been a mixed blessing, really. But thank God we have Zoom. You know, I mean, thank God.
Yeah, yeah. You talk about art also as an outlet, whether it be painting or even writing as a refuge. You know, we've talked about a gratitude journal, but let's talk a little bit more about expressive writing, trying to get our feelings down on paper.
Well, that chapter came out of James Pennebaker's research, which is about the fact that if you write for 3 to 4 times a week for up to 6 weeks, you actually can improve your immune system, lessen anxiety, and lessen depression. It allows us to write in an uninhibited way.
Yeah.
There's an exercise they do where basically you write for up to 15 minutes about something that's really stressing you. And then you step back and you look at it and you say, what are my next steps I have to take? So you sort of move from the right side of the brain where you're just a lot of emotion and spilling over to the left where you step back and say, okay, what do I need to pay attention to in this piece of writing? Also, the fact that the act of putting words, experiences into words, requires a certain organization and integration of your experience. And so it helps you see your experience on paper. Yeah. And there's a lot of I lead a therapeutic writing group for people with cancer, and there's a lot of a lot of healing that happens in that modality. Mm-hmm. When we write, we access our unencumbered voice in a way that when we're talking, it's different. So if I were talking to you and we were across the table from each other, mm-hmm. I would be unconsciously watching when you nodded or when you looked perplexed, and then I would be correcting myself or modifying my speech to make myself clear. When I'm writing, there's no feedback mechanism. I'm having an encounter with myself on the paper.
Yeah.
And so I'm more apt to access an unencumbered voice that's not encumbered by other people's expectations or needs. Do you know what I'm saying? Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Yeah. So I found writing to be an incredibly powerful route into healing.
Well, in the work that you do, you get a lot of people who ask you questions, and you even have a section called Questions People Ask. And one of the questions was, how long does grief typically last?
Mm-hmm. That is the question. And I think I read somewhere, these are not my answer. I think it might have been David Kessler, but I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. That grief lasts as long as you love. And I like that. I can't claim that as my own words, but it just made a lot of sense.
Yeah.
But, you know, what I always say, and I think it's really important, when you first lose somebody you love, everything in front of you, the ceiling, the roof, the rug, the furniture, the walls in your house are searing pain. Over time, different resources come between your grief and your life, and it fills in. And so it moves from a searing pain to a dull ache.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like breaking a bone. You break a bone, it kills at first. Then maybe you have some surgery, you have a cast, you maybe have some PT. And on rainy days, it always aches.
Mm.
And so there's always a chair in the room that's gray that's for your grief. But it's no longer the rug, the floor, the ceiling, the colors of the walls, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a back seat, and it moves from the searing pain to a dull ache, and it takes as long as it takes. I think one of the things that is one of the myths is that grief gets better after a year. Sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't, because sometimes the first year is filled with the tasks of closing somebody's life,
mm-hmm.
just the multitude of tasks. And that provides a structure and a meaning for your life. And often you can't cope with those things and deal with your feelings at the same time. And so we make the decision to cope because that's what we have to do. And then often when those things are settled, then we start to feel the loss in a different way, and we start to deal with the feelings of it. And so sometimes the second year can be a little tougher. Not always, but I think people come into it with the expectation that it'll be easier the second year, and it's just not always the case.
Yes.
Sometimes it is, but I just like to always say that so when people enter the second year and they're finding themselves, whoa, I didn't expect to still have this sadness, I can say, well, this is not an unusual experience.
Mm.
It's the way it is for some people.
Mm. There was another question I wanted to ask you, and it said, my partner died after a long illness. I feel guilty because I'm experiencing more relief than sadness. What if I'm not grieving enough or grieving at all? How do you respond to that?
I say relief is a common feeling after someone's been suffering for a long time. You're no longer living in anticipation mm-hmm. of when they're going to die. You're no longer living in anticipation of what it's going to be like and how much suffering are you going to have to endure.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be that you've done much of your grieving while they were in the dying process.
Yeah.
We don't know, but grief will come when it needs to come.
Yeah.
Just make sure when it comes to make room for her.
Mm-hmm.
Make a room for grief if she knocks at your door.
Yeah.
There's a great poem by Rumi called The Guest House. I'm sure you know it.
Yes.
Yeah, I think about that all the time. make room for whatever comes, because each has been, whatever comes meaning a feeling, is each has become as a guide from beyond. That's so beautiful.
Yes, it is.
It's so beautiful.
And there was a little section called Being with Beauty and the need for that, and I thought about John O'Donohue, and I thought about his book, Beauty, the Invisible Embrace. And he had a chapter in that book called The Beauty of Death.
Oh, which, I don't know this.
Yeah, I can't recount exactly what he shared in that, other than there was one section on when a person dies in their bed no longer is a deathbed. It's now a sacred altar because a spiritual transformation has taken place.
Oh, that's interesting.
And you're familiar with John's writings. He's so poetic.
That's beautiful.
But I had never read anything about the beauty of death before until I read it in that one book that John wrote, Beauty of the Invisible Embrace.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to look that book up. That sounds wonderful.
Well, this book is wonderful. I highly recommend people get a copy. It's coming out, I believe, now, correct?
It's out now.
Yeah.
Yes.
And where can he find more information about this book, a little bit more about you as well?
Well, you can go to my website, which is openingtogrief.com, and you could also go to the Facebook page, openingtogrief.com, but probably the website is the best place to start, and there's a series of events there. If people want to come to a book launch, there are launches being held all over the country, and the first one is on November 9th at the Brookline Booksmith. Mm-hmm. Where my co-author will be there. She won't be at most of these, but she will be there then. So,
wonderful.
And I would also say I hope people will buy locally to support our bookstores
Yes.
who are in so much trouble and review on Amazon.
Yes, exactly. Thank you for that plug for our local bookstores. They really do need that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I just love going to my local bookstore, and it's such a treat, you know.
And Claire, it must be gratifying. You've had a lot of wonderful people sign off on this book. Sharon Salzberg says, a comforting and elegant collection of healing wisdom, the perfect book for our times. And I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, I've been really moved by what people have written.
Yeah.
I'm so grateful. I'm just so grateful that it's touched people. And I just hope it finds its way to the people who need it the most.
The book is Opening to Grief, Finding Your Way from Loss to Peace. Claire Willis, it's been a delight to have you on the program.
Thank you so much. I love talking to you.
In closing, I'd like to share something that Claire had mentioned, that John O'Donohue wrote on grief, and I just happened to have it in the studio with me. These are John's words, and he writes, "When you lose someone you love, your life becomes strange. The ground beneath you becomes fragile. Your thoughts make your eyes unsure, and some dead echo drags your voice down. Where words have no confidence, your heart has grown heavy with loss. And though this loss has wounded others too, no one knows what has been taken from you when the silence of absence deepens. Flickers of guilt kindle regret for all that was left unsaid or undone. There are days when you wake up happy, again inside the fullness of life, until the moment breaks and you're thrown back onto the black tide of loss. Days when you have your heart back, you're able to function well, until in the middle of work or an encounter, suddenly with no warning, you are ambushed by grief. It becomes hard to trust yourself. All you can depend on now is that sorrow will remain faithful to itself. More than you, it knows its way and will find the right time to pull and pull the rope of grief until that coiled hill of tears has reduced to its last drop. Gradually, you will learn acquaintance with the invisible form of your departed. And when the work of grief is done, the wound of loss will heal, and you will have learned to wean your eyes from that gap in the air and be able to enter the hearth in your soul where your loved one has awaited your return all the time." The book we talked about today is Opening to Grief, Finding Your Way from Loss to Peace. I highly recommend you pick up a copy. And you can do so by going to your local booksellers and also visiting the website openingtogrief.com. Again, another big thank you to its amazing author, Claire Willis. And that is today's program. I want to thank you so much for joining me. And so for engineer Genesis Brown and production coordinator Angel Richardson, I'm Richard Brendan. You've been listening to Journey's Fire. We're bringing love to life, one broadcast at a time.